Good afternoon, members. Both of you. I guess we'll get started. As soon as we have a quorum, we can approve the minutes, but just want to draw your attention to a couple of things in your folders. I guess I should also say that our fearless leader, Sheriff Slawick, is not feeling well today as an explanation about why I'm here and she's not. There is a letter from the governor talking about the restrictions on hiring, and you might just make note of that. And then also a letter from the Department of Education with the questions raised about the kindergarten assessment. So please take the time to review those when you have a chance. This afternoon, we will be hearing testimony from the family, friend, and neighbor grant recipients, and then a presentation by the Department of Human Services on the legal non-licensed child care provider home visiting report. And then Representative Aaron Murphy has a bill up for hearing. So why don't we begin with the family, friend, and neighbors grant hearing. And so the first, Deb Swenson-Clatt, I believe, is the first testifier up. Introduce yourself for the record, and then you can...
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Deb Swenson-Clatt. I am the manager of the Child Development Services Unit at the Department of Human Services. We're the unit that oversees child care quality initiatives in Minnesota, and we've had the privilege of beginning to implement the Family, Friend, and Neighbor Grant Program this past year. I will provide an overview of the grants program, and then I understand that there'll be several grantees testifying, as well as our evaluator. You might remember that from research that we've done in Minnesota on the use of child care, that 70% of households that use child care in Minnesota use some form of family, friend, and neighbor care on a regular basis, and that even 46% of these families use FFN care as their primary arrangement. So family, friend, and neighbor care is an important part of the child care system. Minnesota also has one of the largest populations of refugees and immigrants in the country, and for this, those populations, exclusive use of family, friend, and neighbor care is often very common because of the familiarity and ability to maintain cultural values and trust and flexibility offered by family, friend, and neighbor caregivers. Outreach and support to FFN caregivers is a high priority for us. In the department, we provide on an ongoing basis funding to our child care resource and referral agencies across the state to provide some limited support to family, friend, and neighbor caregivers. We're really in the process of building what we think is an infrastructure of support for them, and this legislative grant program is a wonderful addition to what we've been putting in place through the R&R system. The 2007 legislature appropriated $750,000 in grants to provide services to FFN caregivers, and the purpose of the grant program is to promote children's early literacy, healthy development, and school readiness. It also really promotes and fosters community partnerships, and the grants, grant opportunities were made available to community-based organizations, nonprofits, Indian tribes, and libraries, as described in the legislation. We put out a request for proposals last September, and DHS received 22 applications totaling $2.6 million. Out of that a range of proposals, we were able to fund 6 grants, ranging in cost from $54,000 to $139,000. And those grantees, the 6 grantees, have actually leveraged an additional $230,000 in funds that they have brought to the table to support their initiatives. The request for proposals stressed partnerships in order to really unite efforts in local communities to serve family, friend, and neighbor caregivers and the families that they serve, And we are beginning already to see evidence of expanded awareness of the needs of family, friend, and neighbor caregivers, expanded resources, and new connections to serve this population. I'll just say a few words about each of the six grantees, and you should have as a handout a grant announcement that describes each grantee in a little bit more detail. So I will quickly run through each of these. Neighborhood House, who is here today to provide an overview of their project, is working with a developer of low-income housing projects and the Children's Museum and Prevent Child Abuse Minnesota to support family, friend, and neighbor caregivers primarily in the Latino and Somali populations in St. Paul. The Early Childhood Training and Resource and Training Center in Minneapolis will be focusing on the urban American Indian population and the FFN caregivers in that population, and has an innovative connection with the University of Minnesota and their dental care program. The Hennepin County Library, it will be training community ambassadors from different populations to connect FFN caregivers and the families they serve with important resources, and a part of their initiative includes a practice preschool for children in FFN care settings. Up in the Arrowhead area, the Northland Foundation is another grantee that has pulled together an amazing coalition of organizations, including four counties, two library systems, the Fond du Lac Indian Reservation, school districts, the Early Childhood Family Education Programs and Head Start Programs, and the United Way. And they are going to be supporting family, friend, and neighbor caregivers through partnerships. Included in their grant proposal is the concept of creating innovative concept funds to allow each of the communities that they're supporting to generate new innovations in working with family, friend, and neighbor caregivers. The Whiters Indian Reservation Child Care Program, also here today, is working with three counties as well as tribal organizations with their new Readmobile. Programs and materials that they're developing will be made available in the Ojibwe language. And finally, there's another grant to the Grant County Source and Library community. Their project incorporates three school districts, ECSE programs, a medical center, a local family service collaborative, and the University of Minnesota Extension Nutrition Education Program, and their local fire department, to develop innovative ways to reach FFN caregivers and their families in their county. And they have no private pre-K facilities in their county. So again, these efforts will really assist in serving the many families who use FFN care in their communities. The grants have truly expanded and are expanding the scope and number and types of organizations working actively with FFN caregivers and the families that use this type of care. New outreach activities are being developed, new curriculum is being developed, and existing curriculum enhanced and translated into languages, including Ojibwe, as I mentioned, and Spanish and Somali. Programs are engaged in both working with providers, but also working with parents to become leaders in their communities. And the grants are opening up a range of possibilities for new outreach to FFN caregivers. Finally, a part of the legislation stated that DHS should work with the University of Minnesota to develop an evaluation of these grant programs, and we have begun that partnership with the Center for Early Education and Development, also here to share with you a little bit more about the evaluation of the program, both through SEED's efforts and through our own monitoring and technical assistance to the grantees. We will be closely looking at how these activities can be sustained and promoted and encouraged throughout our statewide infrastructure. Thank you very much.
Okay. I think before we go to further testimony, let's gavel the committee together since we have a quorum here. And we need to look at the minutes and approve them. So if you could take a quick look at them, and is anyone prepared to approve the minutes? Representative Murphy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll move the minutes.
Okay. Any additions or changes to the minutes? Okay. Seeing none, all those in favor of approving the minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Okay. The minutes are approved. Okay. Let's, should we have Neighborhood House come up then? And then, please introduce yourself for the record when you begin to speak. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Renee Oswald Anderson, Vice President of Community Building at Neighborhood House, and we're delighted to be here, as well as my colleague from the Children's Museum.
I'm Sarah Caruso, President of Minnesota Children's Museum.
To tell you, I've got a booming voice. I probably don't really need this, but keep hearing me. To tell you a little bit about who Neighborhood House is and how excited it is to bring this partnership together and be a part of it is, Neighborhood House is a 110-year-old multicultural community center located on the west side of St. Paul. And our purpose and mission is about helping new Minnesotans find their place and become active, engaged community residents. And we do that through parent education, parenting and land. We have a large English language learning program, a large youth program, after school help, tutoring programs, multicultural food shelf, a whole array of services. Last year in 2007, we served 10,000 unduplicated participants, and our facility had 52,000 visitors from across Minnesota and across the community. And Sarah will describe the Children's Museum, and then we'll talk a little bit about our exciting partnership.
Hello, I've met many of you before as we have talked in the Early Childhood Caucus and talked about Minnesota Children's Museum. Just a very brief kind of three-sentence reminder of who we are. We're located in downtown St. Paul, and we consider ourselves a place of early childhood learning. Our mission is to spark children's learning through play, and we work with very young children ages, really birth through age 10. Our focus is to provide both a rich learning and play experience at our location, where we serve at least 400,000 families a year. And families is an important operative word. We're one of the few free choice destinations for parents and children together that have such a strong educational focus. We also have an increasingly important community partnership outreach initiative where we are working both in professional development, training daycare, preschool, and early elementary school teachers teaching and working with young children in a very hands-on, experiential way, which is our specialty. And we also have really, in the past few years, invested a great deal of time and effort into these community partnership kind of programs, knowing that not every family wakes up on Saturday morning and says, let's go play at Minnesota Children's Museum. So it's through these partnerships, and I think you'll see both the professional development side and the family partnership side that our museum is working to do, and this grant is a great example of that.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to be here. And one of the really fun things, and Sarah was very articulate about it, is really bringing partners like Neighborhood House, who work directly with the families, and resources like the Children's Museum together in a very intentional way. And we have a large collaborative, but we've all worked together in different capacities and now actually all got to sit around the table together and work together. And so it's Neighborhood House, Common Bond Communities, which is about affordable housing across Minnesota, Prevent Child Abuse Minnesota, Resource for Child Caring, who has marvelous curriculum, and then the Minnesota Children's Museum, which is a wonderful place for our kids and families. It's one of our favorite field trips. Our bilingual staff and volunteers take the kids and their moms and dads on occasion to the Children's Museum, and it is always one of the highlights of parenting in a new land in terms of some of our curriculum. We're really focused on families who are residing in Ramsey County and in some targeted neighborhoods and targeted subsidized and affordable housing. Neighborhood House has a community-based family center on the west end and as well as on the west side. We work closely with Sibley Manor Apartments, which has 540 low-income housing units that are primarily families who are as first language Spanish speakers, a large East African community, and specifically Somali families and Ethiopian families. Dineen Terrace with St. Paul Public Housing is right behind our center. It's also low-income housing, and again, very multicultural and culturally rich community in terms of Somali families, Latino families, African American and Hmong families. And then Skyline Towers is a common bond community, is St. Paul's home to many of the Somali families in the St. Paul area. The project goal, as we heard earlier, is really to think about bringing parents as providers. And before we wrote the proposal collaboratively, we did some informal surveys and talked to parents and families and talked about how many of you are watching other people's children, how many of you are involved in caring for a neighbor's child, another set of siblings in your apartment building, a grandparent. And one of the things we found was 8 out of 10 of the families we talked to in one of our classes were all FFNN providers, and how much they would benefit from curriculum focused around parenting in a new land, what are the community norms, what are the resources, the wonderful resources in our communities. And so that's really one of the great opportunities in this proposal, is to really impact 200 children at a very young age in terms of early literacy and getting them ready for school. And when you think about children who've grown up in refugee camps, who now have an opportunity to be able to read at grade level when they're in second or third grade, that's really powerful. So we're putting together culturally competent services and programs, tools, as well as wonderful resources and materials from research at the Child Caring, from the Children's Museum, what a wonderful place to be and learn with, and as well as prevent child abuse in Minnesota. They have a marvelous parent leadership curriculum. Each of us have distinct roles and responsibilities that are outlined in the proposal and among partner agreements, and bring a collective years and years of experience. Neighborhood House has been around 110 years, and obviously have always worked with children and families. And our goal is to support the informal providers and to work with all of their strengths and assets, and then really to address those unmet needs in this partnership. Sarah is going to share with you some of the innovations that we predict will come out of this partnership, as we have just gotten started on rolling out all of its phases of implementation. Thank you.
Thanks, Renee. I want to highlight two innovations that hopefully will be food for thought for this committee as we work together this year and in 2 years. But before I do that, I just want to make one comment that for me has been sort of an aha. Friend, family, neighbor network is a very important concept, and you're hearing from the experts at BHS and Amy Sussman-Stillman on this. And for a while, I, speaking just from my point of view, started to think of FFN as like a real thing, you know, like, oh, there's this FFN network out there. And what's important, and what I think this grant represents, is there is not one provider of informal home daycare who would stand up and say, I'm an FFN provider. They would say, I'm an auntie, I'm a grandma, I'm a friend, I'm just doing this one afternoon a week. And so the difficulty, now, calling them FFN providers and providing intentional work to support these people as home child care providers is really important from a policy standpoint. My point is simply from an application standpoint, and really connecting and working deeply with these adults who are providing sometimes brief care, sometimes very substantive care, is a difficult thing because they don't self-identify. They're just doing this because this is what they've done all their life, or this is part of their culture, or this is how they're comfortable working with other people. And so I'm thrilled over my relatively short tenure in early childhood, this notion of SSN care is really taking hold and we're working on it. I just wanted to share that insight that for me has been very powerful, to remember we're really dealing on a real one-to-one basis. So the two innovations we wanted to just highlight for you, and I think you've seen evidence of this in our just being here, is first of all, this partnership of five organizations that have never worked together as a five-person collaborative. We've known each other. We've respected each other's work. Some have worked one-on-one. But I think our example is one of just community partnerships that really cross the line from social service agencies and education agencies. The second piece we want to highlight is really the RFP process. And we had thought to the Department of Human Services for putting together an RFP process with substantial amount of money that it really got our attention and brought these innovative ideas forward. And I think that partnership or the RFP process behind a specific topic that's important, friend, family, neighbor care, with significant dollars, in and of itself, that it was an innovative process that brought forth a lot of good ideas, probably which the department, as we often do, wish they could fund all of them. And so I think this model of designating substantial funds behind specific areas that you want to address is one I would encourage you to consider. I've talked to Karen Carlson over at the Department of Ed about it too in early childhood. It is an approach which I think brings out the best in organizations such as ours to find innovative ways to work together.
Thank you. Questions, comments from members? Okay, well, thank you. So then we have the White Earth Reservation Tribal Council representative. And I understand that you've come, is it a five-hour drive from?
About 4 hours.
About 4 hours. Well, thank you so much for coming all this way to testify before us. Please introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Barb Faber, and I'm with the White Earth Council Program. And you have our brochure with you. And I want to thank you for allowing us this opportunity and to fund this project. FSN care is informal care. And on our reservation, our reservation is about 1,300 square miles. And we do have a casino. And so informal care is huge up on our reservation. And because we are a sovereign nation, we do receive child care development funds, which is the CCDBG, just as the states do. However, those funds are federal funds, and we're limited to eligible CCDF families. So when this funding came available, we were very excited because this allows us to reach out to families that are not CCDF eligible. And this funding is going to allow us to reach out to, we're hoping, 100 FSN providers on our reservation. And what we want to do is we want to make sure that the children and their care are receiving the highest quality care. We want to make sure that they're ready for school, ready to learn, and healthy development. And it's just getting our foot in the door with the FSN provider. As it was previously said, they're grandmas, they're aunties, they're friends. And so, and they've raised children. And that's, some of them, just feel that way. But when you get in the door, it's building that relationship with them and building on what they already know, talking about school readiness, getting them involved with school readiness, getting them excited about it, getting the parents and the providers to talk about school readiness is very special. We want to be the hub of child care resources for the White Earth Reservation. And we already do licensing. We already do child care subsidies to our CCDF. And so this funding is going to allow us to reach FSN providers that we normally wouldn't. And so we'll be doing home visits, as the brochure says. We have a Reedmobile, first tribal Reedmobile in Minnesota. And that goes out on the road and does community outreach. and promotes literacy with licensed provider and now FSN care. We'll be doing training opportunities. We'll be providing literacy tips to them and just visiting with them on a monthly basis just to promote quality care and provide incentives. The other brochure that you have with you is the Caring for Kids brochure that we have. We're also an early childhood community initiative project, and that was initiated through there. When FSN providers or parents participate in training, parent conferences, immunizations, they receive points. And when they get enough points, they can go to our Caring for Kids store and purchase things with their points, such as anything from diapers to laundry soap to toys to health and safety to books. So that's another thing that they'll be eligible for.
Okay. Members, any questions or comments? I noticed in the one brochure you make mention of Ojibwe language resource materials.
Yes.
Is that something that gets utilized a fair amount? Or?
Yes. There isn't a lot out there. You really have to look for, especially children's books in Ojibwe language. And so we're hoping to work on adapting some children's books that are already out there and just adapting them to Ojibwe language. And we do have some on the regional field, but we want to promote more because just out of our tribe, the White Ojibwe Nation, there's approximately 20,000 members and less than 1% can speak the language. So our language is dying ever so slowly. So there are small pockets of initiatives going on, and we try to embed a new initiative, language preservation, in everything we do. So,
okay.
Are you doing that?
Oh, thank you very much.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Next we have Dr. Amy Sussman-Silman, and I'm wondering if we could also have Deb Swenson-Klatt join you at the table in case we have questions for her. No. I couldn't see you behind the chairs there, so I appreciate your... Since I didn't give members a chance to ask questions of you before, I thought it would be good to have you come back.
Good afternoon.
Please introduce yourself for the...
Sure. My name is Amy Sussman-Silman, and I am the Director of Applied Research and Training at the University of Minnesota's Center for Early Education and Development, also known as CEED, C-E-E-D. And CEED, for those of you who are unfamiliar with our center, is a center within the College of Education and Human Development at the University of Minnesota, and we have three foci to our work around early care and education: research and evaluation, training, and outreach. And I invite you to visit our CEED website to learn more about the range of things we do, because we are quite engaged in a number of areas. And my work centers largely on examining ways to improve the quality of early care and education. And I've been tracking the emerging work on family, friend, and neighbor care over the past 5 years. So I was really pleased to see that this legislation had gotten passed. And while family, friend, and neighbor care is the single most common form of child care in this country, and has been for as long as anyone can remember, very few states have really devoted the kind of time and attention that family, friend, and neighbor care deserves and needs. And Minnesota, I believe, is really groundbreaking in its focus on FSN, starting with the studies by Wilder Research and Child Trends and others, and continuing with this grant program. You've already heard from the Department of Human Services and two of the grantees, and my purpose here today is to discuss our progress on the evaluation and the current plan for the evaluation of the grant program, as we were designated in the legislation to conduct the evaluation. And so I quickly will just run through some of the things that we have done to date and what our plan is. So we have our evaluation team in place, and we have also added within our CEED team consultation with a colleague of ours at Child Trends, who also has expertise in working with Family Friend and Neighbor Providers. That's Dr. Catherine Tout. We've been working closely with the DHS staff around the legislation and evaluation ideas, and since then we've developed some evaluation products, one of which you have in front of you, which are the evaluation questions. We have also held our first meeting with all the project grantees, which happened 2 weeks ago, and which was extremely exciting. You heard just briefly from two of the grantees. We had the luxury of a whole day of talking with them and hearing about the projects, and it was just a really inspiring day for us who were listening to the creativity and the insight that the projects are bringing to their work. And after my tracking of a number of different Family Friend and Neighbor projects in different places over the years, I can honestly say that right now I was just thought these were some of the most innovative and creative ways that projects are trying to work with providers. So it's really just a great opportunity for us to be able to conduct an evaluation of the program. And at the same time, it also makes us keenly aware of what some of the challenges will be. So I'm just going to walk through a couple of those challenges for you at this time. And these are some of the same issues that programs will face as well, and you heard a little bit about them earlier. One of them is that these are incredibly diverse populations, and so there's a range of language and literacy levels that we will be needing to work with, and differences in ideas about receptiveness to evaluation and research. So our work with Family, Friend, and Neighbor Providers has already shown us that's stuff we need to be thinking about, and so we have been giving it a lot of thought, and really we'll be working closely with the grantees to have them help us so that we can collect data in a way that's respectful and comfortable to the participants in the project. And we know that will get us the best kind of data as well, so it works for on all ends. I really appreciated what Sarah Caruso was just saying about FFN, because I also have some stories just like that, where, and in fact this comes from a local colleague who works in the early care and education field, and she said, was talking about taking care of her grandchildren one day and said, you know, for a long time it didn't dawn on me that I was a family friend and neighbor provider. I just thought I was a grandma. And I looked at her and I thought, that's incredible. She works at a local training organization here in town in early care and education. And so it just emphasized again that family friend and neighbor care is community work, and there's an incredible amount of passion and pride that providers bring to this work, and we want to honor that and be able to capture that as well in the evaluation. And we think there are a lot of strengths that family, friend, and neighbor providers also bring that we can build on. One is in the evaluation is that they have an open mind to learning more about how to support the children they care for. Otherwise, they wouldn't be participating in these projects. So, and the fact that they're interested will help us, I think, in the evaluation, because they'll probably want to know what's the kind of impact these programs will be having, and hopefully will help them be some forthcoming in giving us their impressions about how the programs work. And you also have a handout of what some of the evaluation questions are. So briefly, we're going to ask questions about the programs. We're going to ask some questions about the caregivers themselves, and we're going to ask some questions about the children. And we developed these questions based on the legislation and our work with DHS, and also in talking with the grantees. And we're waiting to get some more feedback on the questions and our planning. So the questions about the programs will be about where the programs delivered as they were intended, and what were the successes and challenges that were encountered, and were the programs able to successfully engage providers, and for the programs that have a component that is also directly involving the children, were they also able to directly engage the children, and what were some of the features of the programs that related to some of the outcomes, which parts of the program seemed to be the most beneficial. We're interested in the caregivers. Obviously, the caregivers being the closest to children, their interactions with the children produce the most important impact on children's development. And so we're interested in knowing whether or not they have changed or increased the number of kinds of engagement and activities related to school readiness. So are they reading more with children? Are they using community resources more? So on and so forth. things like that? Have they actually learned some more specific things, more knowledge about child development in general? And are they interested in their own, in continuing their own self-education around these issues? And then for children, we're interested in knowing if their development is, if their developmental status, we say in our field, is on track. Our kids, the kids look like they're doing okay. And so we'll describe, we plan to describe the features of the program and the opportunities and how family, friend, and neighbor platters are using those opportunities and how they're increasing their access to resources in the community. And those, and to see if the organizations then have been able to increase their capacity to serve family, friend, and neighbor providers. So, open, I guess we're open for questions if you have any. And
members, any comments or questions? And you're in the process of beginning this evaluation, is that right? Or
that's right. We just, our contract with the Department of Human Services is just in place for a few weeks, and so
okay. We're
pretty quickly working with grantees.
Okay. So I was going to ask if you had encountered any challenges or difficulties you hadn't anticipated, but if you haven't really started yet, I guess you...
Yeah, not yet. But we'll keep a list for you.
Okay. All right. Any questions for Deb Swenson Klatt and her presentation? Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's not a question, but I did want to say that it is encouraging to see how quickly we've moved from bill passage to the implementation, that the grants have been awarded and we're putting the money to use and there's progress being made, and I'll be eager to hear more about the evaluation as you progress. And thank you for your hard work.
Thank you. Anyone else? Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And so next we have a presentation by the Department of Human Services and Sherry Kohlneck. Is that right? Did I murder your name? You'll have to tell us what it is so I learn it better.
And Mr. Chair, my name is Sherry Kohlneck, and it's not really my name, it's my husband's, and I'm not quite used to it yet. It's only been 34 years.
Okay, all right. Thank you. And you may proceed with your time.
All right. My name is Sheree Kotelnik, and I am the manager of the Child Care Assistance Program. And our division in the Department of Human Services works with the Child Development Services Division and a number of other agencies to prepare this legal non-licensed child care provider report for you this year. And you asked us to talk with you about home visiting program options. I think it's interesting that I'm following these innovative community-based models with a report about what statewide programs exist for home visiting and the potential for expanding those to legal non-licensed providers in the Child Care Assistance Program. And as we go forward here a little bit, you'll kind of see why. In the legislation, first for clarification purposes, the title was Inspection of Legal Non-Licensed, and then it was Visits to Receive Information on Health and Safety. We made some assumptions as we went forward with this report. We didn't look at this as an inspection. We looked at this as a visit for supporting health and safety in school readiness, and so we approached it that way. We looked at home as the home where the child care provider worked in, which might have been in the child care provider's home, or it might be in the family's home for legal non-licensed care. So just for purposes of that, the focus is on the provider, but the provider might be in their own home, might be in somebody else's home. And we're talking about, we're not giving you recommendations in this report. We're giving you information about the options that currently exist for statewide models and some of the advantages and disadvantages that the group that got together saw when they looked at these options. So with that in mind, our other stakeholders included people from the Department of Health, the Department of Human Services, Department of Education with the Child and Adult Care Food Program, Department of Education with ECFE programs, the Minnesota Child Care Resource and Referral Network, Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators, the Child Care Works, Resources for Child Caring, Early Childhood Resource and Training Center, and Minnesota Licensed Family Child Care Association, and Ready for K. So a lot of stakeholders who have an interest in family, friend, and neighbor care and have... who are responsible for a piece of the system that supports families and providers in Minnesota. All the stakeholders brought their viewpoints to the table. There were two meetings and an email follow-up for those who couldn't attend. We discussed the existing model for home visiting. We brainstormed about options and the advantages and disadvantages. We did not do any detailed analysis of fiscal impact. We can assume that expanding the service population focus or content of any of the current models would cost money. So if you focus in on a model that you want us to think about more carefully and expand on, then that might be the time to start talking about the potential fiscal impact of that particular model. But it would be a huge project to do a fiscal analysis of all the models that might be built upon. Just a few background statistics about family, friend, and neighbor providers. You heard a lot about that in previous presentations. It is the most common type of child care in Minnesota. It's being utilized by almost half of Minnesota families that use child care. We talk about family, friend, and neighbor child care providers as the providers who are available to all of the families in Minnesota who use family, friends, and neighbors. For purposes of the Child Care Assistance Program, we define a subset of that program as legal non-licensed providers. They are people who have to be registered to serve families in the Child Care Assistance Program and to receive payments. So when you hear the term legal non-licensed, it's a subset of the total world of family, friends, and neighbor providers. And hopefully we'll be clarified that a little bit in this report. In fiscal year 07, approximately 26% of the care provided to children on the Child Care Assistance Program was provided by family, friend, and neighbor caregivers. So it's not the 50% of most of the Minnesota population. There are approximately 150,000 households with family, friend, and neighbor care in Minnesota, and 7,700 legal non-licensed providers were serving children who participate in Minnesota's Child Care Assistance Program in 06, and they touched the lives of over 16,000 children. Pages 2 and 3 of the report, I think you all have the report, gives more detailed information about the characteristics of the family, friend, and neighbor and legal non-licensed populations. Those statistics are from two reports that Amy Sussman-Stillman referred to that the Department of Human Services has commissioned. One of them is the Family, Friends, and Neighbors report that was published in 2004. And it's the results of the Minnesota Statewide Household Child Care Survey. And the other is Family, Friends, and Neighbors Caring for Children through the Minnesota Child Care Assistance Program. And one of the, you know, one of the exciting things about these two reports being done together is that we not only know now about more information about family, friends, and neighbors and the work that they do caring for children from the total population, but we know the differences or have a better understanding of the differences between those family, friend, and neighbor caregivers and those that care for families in the Child Care Assistance Program. So there's some really good information on page 2 and 3 of the report that talks about that. But the part that I found really interesting about that is the diversity. 53% of the legal non-licensed providers in the Child Care Assistance Program are European American. The rest are not. So the model that needs to be developed needs to take into consideration the characteristics of the population. 40% of the legal non-licensed providers have some college education. 50% have participated in parent education. 38% participated in child care training. Many others have done very little when it comes to education and support or early childhood education. So as Amy said, there's a wide range of diversity in the needs for support and education. And the other thing that I find really interesting in these statistics is that on average, family, friend, and neighbor caregivers provide care for about 19 hours a week. When the legal non-licensed providers are serving children in the Child Care Assistance Program, the mean number of hours of care per week is 38 hours. So they really are doing this as a full-time job when they do it in the Child Care Assistance Program. Both of these full reports, research reports, are available on the DHS website if you want to know more about family, friend, and neighbor caregivers. Okay, with those things in mind, we looked at the stakeholder group looked at three major options for conducting home visits. One would be developing a new program to implement the legislation. One is adding to an existing program to implement the legislation, and the other is adopting an alternative to home visiting. So those are the ideas that the stakeholder committee looked at. When it came to option one, developing a new one-time home visiting program for legal non-licensed providers, As we looked at the other models that exist in the state, we realized that there is a significant amount of infrastructure that has to be put in place to develop a statewide home visiting model. You need to come up with qualified educators. You need to come up with the parameters around the visits. You need to coordinate with other organizations that are already doing this work. And so there is an infrastructure cost to building a new program. There also is an opportunity, if you're not doing a statewide program, to build off of community efforts that are already happening and can be expanded. You heard about a lot of those community efforts in the previous presentations about the Family Friend and Neighbor Grant program. There are a lot of things that are happening, but it's not a one-size-fits-all kind of thing for Minnesota. It wouldn't be a statewide program, but there's potential to build off of that. Option two is incorporating legal non-licensed home visiting into an existing visiting program that already is in existence. There are home visiting programs to parents or home-based providers already existed three agencies and numerous other entities. Most of them focus on parents. Most of the ones that talk about parent education or talk about school readiness are focusing on parents. There are ones that focus on providers, but that focus is more around administrative responsibilities and nutrition education. So we'll go forward with those models and some of the thoughts about those. There's the Family Home Visiting Program that's operated by the Minnesota Department of Health. They do focus on school readiness, health and safety information is being delivered through this program. They have outreach people who are trained to do this kind of education. They're currently targeted to families at risk and who have incomes under 200% of federal poverty guidelines. So they are positioned educationally and with an administrative structure that could be expanded to legal non-licensed providers, but that is not currently their focus and it would require investment to expand. Another program is ECFE, which is under the auspices of the Minnesota Department of Education. The purpose of the visit is parent education. It could be provider education. It's around school readiness. It's around child development. It's around important things like that. And their mission is to provide parent education to isolated or at-risk families. Currently, this program provides services primarily in a group setting, and people come to the education, but it does include an option for home visiting. There aren't a lot of home visits that are provided through the ECFE program, but that doesn't mean that the infrastructure isn't there that couldn't be expanded on. Again, they're already underfunded for the population that they're intended to serve. Another existing program that people have talked about is the Child and Adult Care Food Program. This is also under the auspices of Minnesota Department of Education, and it has the administrative structure in place to reach out to licensed child care providers. This is federally funded, and with federal funding, there come a lot of requirements for accountability for funds and for administrative tracking. So there is a heavy administrative burden that comes with this one. It does include a home visiting component, so they have people who go out to child care providers and are used to interacting with licensed child care providers, and there is a structure in place for this to happen through community organizations. Two options were talked about with the Child and Adult Care Food Program for potential expansion to serve legal non-licensed providers in the Child Care Assistance Program. One that was offered up was using the existing Child and Adult Care Food Program infrastructure to add a component that reaches out to legal non-licensed providers. It, on the surface, this seems to be something that's fairly workable. I would say that there are some potential pitfalls to that in that most of that infrastructure is paid for with federal funds and needs to be accountable to the primary purpose, which is reaching out to licensed family child care providers who are participating in the Child and Adult Care Food Program. If their focus was expanded, there'd need to be considerable administrative accountability to assure that federal funds are being spent for federal purposes and state funds are being spent for state purposes. Another option that people talked about was expanding the Child and Adult Care Food Program to include legal non-licensed providers in Minnesota. The goal was that the CACFT monitors health and other conditions, and it draws down federal funding. So on the surface, again, this appears to be something that, oh, great, there'd be, you know, new money available to the states, and we could visit providers, and we could draw down food program money for that. Currently, Minnesota does not expand to legal non-licensed providers with the Child and Adult Care Food Program, and the visits are not focused on school readiness. One of the reasons we have chosen not to expand to legal non-licensed providers in Minnesota is the administrative requirements, and the population that we would be trying to expand to is one that is generally really fluid and not prone to wanting to keep a lot of records. So that will be one of the disadvantages of expanding this. And if you have more questions about the Child and Adult Food Program, we do have an expert with MDE here to talk about that. Option three is an alternative to a formal home visit, and in order to talk about this, I wanted to just mention a couple things that already exist for legal non-licensed providers. The Department of Human Services issues a bulletin every year that announces health, safety, every several years, that announces health, safety, and other resources for legal non-licensed child care providers and families. And our rule and statute requires that each county provide health and safety materials to each authorized provider and refer the provider to child care resources and referral agencies per Minnesota rule requirements. So our counties right now are giving information to every legal non-licensed provider in the state, and they have the option to decide how they're going to disseminate that information and what information they're going to disseminate. The bulletin that we issue identifies lots of different resources that are available for them to come up with information and to develop their packets for providers. So that exists right now. It is not a home visit. Most counties would not do a home visit, and they don't necessarily have a face-to-face with the providers. Another option that the stakeholder group talked about was potentially requiring parents and providers to attend an orientation training that focuses on some of the things in the health and safety bulletin so that they're getting the information, the parents and providers are getting it at the same time, or giving the information to parents and providers and asking them to, you know, affirm that they have read it or somehow show us that they've spent some time looking at the information and know some things about it. It's not a home visit. It's not necessarily an interactive discussion with a provider, but it would be a step up from what we're doing now. So at that's the end of the report. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them.
Yeah, very thorough. Any questions or comments, members? Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Kitelnik, love the name, by the way, since you're still considering it. I'm just curious about the other issues needing future consideration as those are still being wrestled with by the group.
Well, depending on the other issues are things that were not resolved by the committee, but were things that we know that if a model is developed, that needs to be considered. So anyone who goes into a provider situation and sees something that perhaps shouldn't be happening with kids raises questions about whether they should be a mandated reporter for child abuse and neglect. Some of the models that we talked about here have addressed that in their home visiting protocol. If it were expanded to this population, they'd need to consider whether or not that mandated reporting function expands also. And if we're developing something, then we would certainly want to determine whether or not that's a piece that could be included. And cost was something that I already talked about, and I lost my last page. So what was the last thing?
Multiple visits.
Oh, that's an important piece. There was a lot of discussion around I mentioned that you can hand people stuff and ask them to read it, and that has a limited amount of effectiveness. You can make one visit to someone, and that has a limited amount of effectiveness. And you can develop an ongoing relationship with someone, and that has more, a greater amount of effectiveness over time. People felt like the investment would probably yield a better result if there was a relationship and it was more than one visit.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions or comments? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The bill that we're going to hear is a bill that we heard last session, but with limited funds, we were unable to include it in our omnibus bill, and we'll be hearing several bills over the next few weeks that we heard last session but were unable to fund. So, Representative Murphy, would you like to move your bill to get it before the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'd like to move House File 2920 to be laid over.
Okay, for possible inclusion in the Early Childhood Learning Finance Omnibus Bill. And I think we have a state we'd like to hear from our fiscal analyst, Ms. Adrians, to talk about the fiscal note. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. There's not that much to say about it, but if you will pull out the fiscal note, you'll see that the implication of the change in the House File 2920, and the only real changes are on line 1.9 and 1.10 of the bill, and it's just changing the amount per child spent. So it's changing it from $50 to $75 for a child screened at age 3, from $40 to $70 for child screened at age 4, and from $30 to $65 for a child screened at age 5 or 6. And so the cost in fiscal year 2009 would be about $1.5 million, and then in fiscal year 10 it would be $1.7 million, and the same cost in fiscal year 2011. And the only thing I want to point out is if you're really going to look at the fiscal note in depth, I just want to remind you about the entitlement numbers versus the appropriation numbers. And the way it's appropriated, it's that 90-10 split that we talked about last session. So, you know, you can kind of ignore the entitlement numbers, and the true implication, the true cost is the $1.5 million. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Anyone have any questions? Okay. Representative Murphy, will you present the bill then?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you have heard, members, this is a bill to increase funding for developmental screening in Minnesota schools. And we did hear this bill last year. It was not funded, and we thought it would be important to bring it before you again, knowing that we are not flush with funds. And I have two people that would like to testify today, and I'd like to turn to them and ask them to introduce themselves to the committee and offer their testimony.
Okay. Please identify yourself for the record. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Charlie Blesner. I'm the Community Education Director in District 728. We serve the communities of Elk River, Rogers, Zimmerman, Otsego, and several townships northwest of the Twin Cities. I'm also the past president of the Minnesota Community Ed Association. I'm happy to get some testimony here today, and Ann has suggested that I go first, so I'll do so. What I'd like to do is maybe just provide a little bit of a brief background on the purpose of screening to kind of ground the testimony, and then take a look at some kind of state trends, especially relative to funding, and then localize it to our school district. As the community ed director, I've been involved directly in administering the early childhood screening program since 1991 in our school district. Prior to that time, it was administered by an elementary director. And since that time, it's been in the community ed fold, and currently it's assigned to our early childhood family ed manager. The purpose of early childhood screening is to be a beneficial program to Minnesota's youngest kids. And the whole purpose is to assist parents and communities in improving the health of Minnesota children and in planning educational and health programs for them. The key elements include an early detection of the child's health and development in terms of any problems that might be occurring, to set up referral systems to receive requests that might come out of the screening and that could call for more complete assessments following the screening. Early childhood screening is a pathway for at-risk and developmentally delayed children to access the services of school districts and communities, including their family doctor, school readiness, early childhood special ed, early childhood family ed, and preschool placement. early childhood screening is leads to intervention strategies to reduce the later need for more costly care and services, to minimize physical and or educational disabilities, and to improve the chances of later success for children in school achievement. Without this early intervention, students identified at screening with one or more risk factors are far more likely to lag behind their peers in achievement when they become school age. Early identification has long-term cost savings benefits for local districts, for families, and for the state. Follow-up on referrals is also a key element of the tracking of any referral that comes out of it. So the follow-up process incumbent with screening is a real important element as well. The state mandates a number of things within screening, and then there are also some alternatives or some options that districts can also include. The state requires all school districts to screen children at least once before they enter school in kindergarten. The targeted age is between 3 and 4 years of age, and the state has incentivized local districts to screen kids earlier rather than later with the funding formula. The requirement includes students to continue attending public school if a child enters or attempts to enter without being screened. They need to be screened within 30 days of entry. Students are assigned a MARS number, so a 3-year-old that shows up at screening is assigned a MARS number at that time, and that's how we would track that student through their educational career in the K-12 system. It also provides some accountability for how many kids are screened and for accurate reporting of screened kids. The screening components that are mandated include developmental assessments, hearing and vision screening and referral, immunization review and referral, height and weight, the identification of risk factors that could influence learning, parent interview about the child, and referral and assessment, diagnosis, and treatment when potential needs are identified. Early identification is optimal and critical, and so the state incentivizes, as I said, us to do the screening at 3 years of age, but also it's quite time-consuming and a challenge to get a 3-year-old to focus during one of those screenings. Not every 3-year-old kid, but it's a little tougher order with a 3-year-old than it is with a 4- or 5-year-old. A little bit of this information on the funding history. As I said, I've been involved in this since 1991. I don't even remember what the funding was at that time, but I know in 1999, 2000, the reimbursement rate per child was increased to $40 by the state. That was 9 years ago. In 2005-06, the formula was tweaked a little bit, and that's when the incentive came in. Instead of paying a flat $40 per child, the rate was increased to $50 to reimbursement if the child was 3 years of age, kept at $40 if they were 4 years of age, and reduced to $30 if they were 5 years of age. So you can see the gist is to try to let's get them earlier. According to the 2007 annual report, the Department of Education, and from MARS data compiled by the Department of Education, there were 59,752 children screened last year in 06-07 in Minnesota. 59,752 kids were screened. And the costs that were reported by local districts to the Department of Education to deliver that service was $4,287,656. So just a titch under $4.3 million to deliver that service. Or an average cost of $71.76 per child. $71.76 per child. The revenue forecast that was provided as background in terms of the impact of this bill suggests that in 2009 the current law, if the law is not amended, will allocate $2.662 million in state money towards this effort. And you can see that already last year, that's a couple of years down the pike, and last year the cost to deliver this program locally was almost $4.3 million. Aaron's bill hit the dollar amount right on the head this year. Last year I was here giving this testimony. It was suggested, you know, how come you're not asking for all of it? Because I think at that time the bill was for $60 or something like that. So anyway, you can see the shortfall in terms of this mandated program that's being underfunded currently. A little local information about District 728. We're a pretty good-sized district. We've got about 61,000 residents, over 12,000 K-12 students, and this past year we screened 1,024 children. about 85% of those kids were 3 and 4 year old kids, and about 15% were 5 year olds. So our average age is under. Our reimbursement was $42.46 per kid. We spent $57,000, and not all of our expenses were reported in this area. We had some early childhood family ed and school readiness dollars that were allocated to provide some of the services of this screening, and that we kept those reported in the school readiness budget. So I think our local costs are really close to the $70 figure that the state provides. Just a little bit about how we do our screening. I refer to it as kind of a dental office kind of a scenario. We're really trying to do it in a way that's most convenient for families. And so we have a lot of Saturday mornings. We have a lot of evenings. It's not a 9 o'clock to 3 o'clock kind of thing. And people get a specific appointment, and so they can show up with their child. And the entire screening takes about an hour and 10 minutes for the stations that the family goes through in the course of that appointment. So it's a specific time. It's not a... When we first took the program over, it was a little bit more of what I would call a cattle call operation, where you had a whole bunch of people there, and then you called somebody's name, and they came. They finally got in to do their screening. But now we're very focused on how we do that. We deliver it in a very cost-effective, cost-conscious kind of way. We're very frugal with how we allocate the resources. We're not compensating people overly. Anybody in our program that's doing this work is doing it on a part-time basis. They're getting paid less than a first-year teacher gets paid. And even with that, we're losing money. The more kids we screen, the further behind we get. So in closing, early childhood developmental screening is a really solid program. The state, the stuff that's there, the requirements to do it, makes sense. It's a great way to find issues with kids early to make it so that we can do an intervention and maybe close an achievement gap. Local districts are providing it in a convenient, efficient, I would dare say even frugal way, but with a very much growing deficit across the state, as witnessed by the data that I've shared. The state-mandated program at the current level is funding about 62% of the costs that are being incurred. And HOSTILE 2920 certainly brings the state role back in play, in line, much closer to the actual cost, and I encourage you to consider its adoption. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Ann Hoxie, and I'm here representing the Minnesota School Nurse Organization. I'm the vice chair of that organization. Also, I'm the administrator in St. Paul Public Schools, and for our health services, and in our district, that's where early childhood screening resides. So I've been involved with this program in a variety of ways, probably going back 30 years ago when I took my kid to it, but as an employee, I've been involved with it for over 20 years. And I would just like to echo everything that my colleague here has said, and it's kind of hard to add a lot to that other than to say that I really would ask you to consider this increase in the support of this program. When we hear that across the state, the average cost is $71, and yet we're being reimbursed at $50 for a 3-year-old, $40 for a 4-year-old, and $30 for a 5-year-old, you can really see that that's, at a time when school districts are struggling in a lot of arenas, this is just one more piece that we're picking up. I would also like to echo what was said about what a great program this is. It really is an opportunity where the community comes together to look at kids' readiness for school. And yes, we have some very specialized education services to offer for kids who have delays in their development and are eligible for special education. We have some very excellent programs to offer. But there are a lot of other things that are shared with parents when they participate in early childhood screening. And that is very community specific. But we in St. Paul screen 3,700 kids a year. We share them specific cultural resources. Are they aware of what the Somali community offers? Are they aware what the Hmong community offers? We bring all those resources to them. We bring second language speakers to screening who can
interpret for parents or actually administer the screening in the second language, and then we hand them the information about where they can go to be connected for their family. We work really hard to outreach to all of our community partners to help us find the kids to bring them in. And all of these sorts of things bring a lot of different community organizations together to focus on young children and the readiness of young children for schools. In St. Paul, we've partnered with our city on a Blast Off the K project. And that is great. People think of getting ready for kindergarten when the child's five. We're really, and I think the state is correct, in incentivizing us to look at three-year-olds. But parents are not all there yet. They're not necessarily thinking about school with their three-year-olds. But I think we know that they do need to start thinking about reading to their children more, and they need to start thinking about how ready is their child going to be to participate in the group and be ready for kindergarten. The demands of kindergarten are a lot higher than they used to be. So when I explain to parents what makes this different than their visit to their doctor, I say a lot of it overlaps, but there's a difference. The physician, and remember I'm a nurse, so you know, the physician and nurse practitioners like I am, look at kids from a health perspective. Early childhood screening looks at them for how ready are they for school. And I think you heard that here, but it is a slightly different look. And it's a different sort of support for parents than what they get in their clinic. So I think with 25 years' experience, I can really say this is an excellent program and supports families across the continuum of language experience, cultural experience, and income. And I really just would wish you could really strongly consider supporting this at the level it costs the district. Thank you.
Yeah, I certainly wish that we could. It sounds like it's a very vital program. And Representative Ward, you have a question or comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As a former special ed teacher and a husband of a speech and language teacher and a father of a daughter that is a speech and language teacher, I think it's a great program as well. And help me with this. I can't recall. Teach me about this. Once a child is screened, say they're screened at 3 years old, they're done. They don't get screened at four, they don't get screened at five.
Well, they don't need to be screened at four and five. They can be, and if there's any concerns noted at three, there'd be a process in place so that we wouldn't kind of lose them. Is that kind of what you're asking?
Yes, that's, so are they re-screened then after, if they have a difficulty, speech, language, or development disabled, or whatever, they're re-screened. Do they get reimbursement a second time? That's my real question. How many times do you get reimbursed on a screening? That's what I thought.
Well, that's not absolutely true. The state will pay you for a second screening, but we don't do very many second screenings.
Thank you.
In our case, we do a screening, and if the child. The instrument that we use allows for a rescreen, mm-hmm. and we still only count the child the one time. The rescreen has to take place within a certain period of time, and that's only on a developmental instrument that's a part of our particular screening. And then they can get referred to if they don't pass the screening, they can get referred to other kinds of services, and they could end up being getting a full assessment through early childhood special ed or something like that. We would be counting that child just the one time on a Myers report for screening. Now, I'm not familiar with a process that allows a second screening.
Ms. Oxley?
I think what I meant to say was if a child comes back was screened and was fine at three and the parent then has concerns or somebody else does when they were four and they came back again, then you could be reimbursed at that second time.
Okay. Any other questions? Yes. Representative Eastland?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you a little bit of the history here? Has the state ever reimbursed at the rate of the actual cost?
Ms. Blake.
Representative Eastland, Chairman Bly, when it went to $40 in 1999-2000, I would say it was pretty accurately there. We were not dealing with a deficit at that time in my district with our operation. I think that we are as
as average as the next district is, you know, in terms of how we manage that function. I think we may even have some efficiencies that some other districts don't have because of the numbers of kids that we screen. But yeah, I'd say in 99-2000 at $40, we were pretty close to where we needed to be.
Ruffin Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Looking at the amount of money, I gather you pay the people who do the screening and you provide some training, and are there any other costs associated with the screening? Any materials that you use? What does the money go for?
Mr. Blythe.
Thank you, Representative Peterson, Chairman Blythe. The cost that we have includes, it's largely personnel. We use nurses to do the developmental screening. We use speech and language clinicians to do the developmental screening piece. We use parent educators that are a part of our early childhood family ed program to do the third station, which is the family factor interview. Managing individual appointments for over 1,000 kids and a universe of probably 1,200 names, we assign, I would imagine, about a 6/10 clerk to this function through the course of the year. We spend a couple $1,000s in mailing, postcards and reminders, and then we do phone call contact the day before their screening. There are a few expendable supplies that we use with the screening instruments that we use. It doesn't break the bank, but the preponderance of our costs are personnel costs. And I don't think anybody in our case, they're hourly folks, and we're probably paying people between $15 and $18 an hour. And we're talking, my wife is a speech clinician as well with 30 years of experience, and it's that kind of a person that we would have involved in some of this stuff, and it's so that it's, we're not overcompensating the staff that are doing the work.
Representative Peterson.
I just want to add that we could be tacking administrative expenses onto this, and we're not. That's a very important consideration that occurred to me as soon as you're asking the question. And for the record, we do not have an administrative cost. I don't assign a portion of my time nor a portion of our early childhood family ed manager's time to this, even though we spend time on it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, Mr. Chair, would you? Refresh my memory. Is this mandatory for every child? It's a developmental screening, I know, but it is mandatory that before children start kindergarten, they have to have this test or this kind of screening.
That is correct. In fact, the law says that we must screen the child. If a child shows up in kindergarten, the district legally can deny them access to an education until such time as we screen them. We're a district that doesn't do that. I think some districts do. But we are flagged right away on the first day of school. We're tracking to see who showed up that hasn't been screened. Some families move into the district over the summer and show up on day one. And we have 30 days in which to complete the screening on those kids.
Exactly.
I would just like to add, Chairman, that parents can conscientiously object to this, and some do object to, opt out. They can also have a comparable screening completed at their physician, and some do that.
Okay, Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. hearing the testimony, I assume that volunteers don't play a big role in this screening, or is the difficulty finding anyone who could help do that?
Representative Norton, Chairman Bly. A number of years ago, we did have some volunteers that did the heights and weights, and at this point, we are scheduled for screening about 70 days of the year, and it logistically becomes a real challenge. I think there are some smaller outstate Minnesota communities where it's not uncommon to have volunteers. In our case, I think it's the challenge of having to cover as many hours as we have to cover, as many dates as we have to cover.
Mm-hmm.
To deliver the service to over 1,000 kids, that makes it, you could almost spend enough, the equivalency in managing the logistics of such an endeavor.
That's what I expected.
Yep.
Mr. Chair, just one other question. From the screenings that are done, first of all, the funding goes to the public school district, right?
That's correct.
And they do the screening, regardless of where the child may be enrolled in some other private school or whatever eventually. Okay. With the screening, is there a summary of what you find, so we have some idea of how many students, you know, have deficiencies in certain areas, whether it's hearing or whatever your vision, or is that something that the district tracks or anybody tracks?
Yes. I think I'll probably defer to Ann on this one, but there is a state report that's required annually.
Okay.
I think that the tracking is done in a couple ways. There is a state report done annually where we report not only, you know, numbers screened, but all sorts of other pieces, the age the child is screened at, their home language, and then what the findings were, so that the state can add up those sorts of numbers. We also give the parents an individual report that they have that they can take with them. And then the report does stay with the school district, and if the child ends up in another school district, we often send those reports at the parents' request.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Ward.
Another quick question, Mr. Chair, thank you. If the student is screened by a public health care provider, does the school district get reimbursed for that? Okay, thank you.
All right. Do you have any more comments, Representative Murphy?
Mr. Chair and members, I appreciate your time in hearing this bill.
Okay.
And with that, I renew my motion.
Mm-hmm. Representative Murphy renews her motion that House File 2920 be laid over for possible inclusion in the early childhood learning finance omnibus bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Without any further business, I will call the meeting adjourned. Mm-hmm.